inderdaad na oorlogsperiode is nu demissionair en opnieuw demissionair. En de afgelopen decennia werd het extreemrechts aangejaagde racisme tegen bijvoorbeeld moslims en mensen om de vlucht steeds verder genormaliseerd. Wij roepen als platform Stop Racisme en Stop Fascisme dus op: geef haat geen stem en kom in actie tegen extreemrechts. En deze verklaring is ondertekend door meer dan 275 organisaties en meer dan 360 medestrijders. En ik ga een paar van die namen noemen. Onder de individuen is het welbekende oud-Kamerlid Kata Boegalicht van GroenLinks, die wegens de slappe houding van GroenLinks tot over Palestina is opgestapt. En verder hebben allerlei AFA-afdelingen, of initiatieven beter gezegd, AFA-initiatieven uit de landen ondertekend, AGA voor Palestina, Amsterdam bijeen, anarchistische groep De Zwarte Kraai, anarchistisch collectief Utrecht, de Animal Justice Front, Animal Liberation, heel goed dat de Animal Liberation beweging ook meedoet, de AFA, antifascist, antifast fashion, de studentenvakbond ASV, Emma, christelijk collectief, heel belangrijk dat een christelijke groep zich uitspreekt, diverse COC-groepen, diverse bijeengroepen, de linkere wang, bijna alle Dolomina-groepen. Ik zie hier echt iets van 15 Dolomina-groepen op mijn lijst staan. Yep. Want hoe kun je nou feministisch zijn en niet antifascistisch? I mean, dan heb je iets echt niet helemaal begrepen. Diverse dwarscollectieven, je weet wel, die jonkies die nog enige hoop in GroenLinks zien. De GGZ van Gaza, allerlei andere GroenLinks-afdelingen uit Nijmegen, Landsmeer, Noordwijk, Schagen, Groningen voor Palestine, Drag House of Extinction, The House of Inclusion, diverse klimaatburgemeesters, Malcolm Kraakt natuurlijk, de MCPM, Nijmegen voor Palestine, Radboud Staff voor Palestine, Rebels of Color, een SP-groep uit Amsterdam, Studio Monk, Vluchtalarm, Voedselbossen, Vrije Bond, Woonopstand en heel veel XR-groepen. En tot slot Zaankanten voor Palestina en Zwolle voor Palestina. En vast nog wel meer, want deze stand is van een paar dagen geleden. Dus iedereen, blijf actief, blijf wakker en blijf woke. En ik zie jullie nu, straks en elders in de strijd. Anuta continua.
Gentlemen, the senator repeated, with no intention on your part or mine, you are participating in a small family scene, and I therefore have no choice but to provide you with an explanation, since I believe that only the captain, this mention led to mutual bows, is fully informed of the circumstances. Now I really have to pay attention to every word, Carl said to himself. And looking sideways, he was delighted to see that the stoker was livening up. Through all the long years of my American sojourn, to be sure the word sojourn does not fit in with the American citizen that I am with all my heart and soul, well, through all these long years, I have been living completely cut off from my European relatives, for reasons that, first of all, are irrelevant here, and secondly, would be too upsetting for me to go into now. I actually dread the moment when I will have to explain them to my dear nephew, whereby frank words about his parents and their near and dear will, alas, be unavoidable. He is my uncle, no doubt about it, Carl told himself as he listened. He probably changed his name. My dear nephew has been, let us use the word that most aptly describes what happened, simply thrust aside by his parents, the way one tosses out a cat when it gets annoying. By no means do I wish to gloss over what my nephew has done to merit so severe a punishment, but his transgression was such that the mere mention of it is enough of an exculpation. I like that, thought Carl, but I don't want him to tell the story to everybody. Besides, he can't possibly know about it. Who could have told him? He was, you see, the uncle went on, supporting himself with brief bows on the bamboo cane propped up in front of him, whereby he actually succeeded in forestalling the unnecessary solemnity that his words were bound to assume. You see, he was seduced by a housemaid, Johanna Brummer, a woman of 35. I don't mean to offend my nephew by using the word seduce, but it is difficult to find another word that is equally befitting. At this point, Carl, who had moved fairly close to his uncle, turned around to read the faces of those present and see what impact the story had made. Nobody was laughing. Everybody was listening patiently and earnestly. After all, one doesn't laugh at a senator's nephew at the very first opportunity that presents itself. Rather, it could be said that the stoker was smiling at Carl, albeit quite faintly, which was, first of all, agreeable as a sign of reviving life, and, secondly, excusable, since Carl, in the stoker's cabin, had wanted to hush up his great secret, which was now being made public. "Well, that Brummer woman," the uncle went on, "had a baby by my nephew, a healthy boy who was christened Jacob, no doubt in honor of your humble servant, who, although no doubt mentioned only casually by my nephew, must have succeeded in making a profound impression on her. Fortunately, let me add, for the boy's parents, in order to avoid paying child support or enduring any other scandal involving them, I am not acquainted, I must emphasize, with either the laws over there or the situation of his parents, in order to avoid child support payments and scandal, they shipped off their son, my dear nephew, to America with irresponsibly inadequate baggage, as we can see. And he would be left entirely to his own devices but for the signs and wonders that are still just barely alive in America, if anywhere. And the boy would have gone to the dogs in some alley by the wharves of New York if that maid had not written me a letter, which, after many twists and turns, came into my possession the day before yesterday, providing me with the entire background of the matter, plus a personal description of my nephew, and, sensibly enough, the name of the ship. If my purpose were to entertain you, gentlemen, I could read you a few passages from this letter." He produced and flourished two gigantic, densely written pages from his pocket. The letter would certainly have its effect, for it was written with a somewhat simple, albeit well-intentioned, cunning, and with a great deal of love for the father of the child. But I neither wish to entertain you any more than is necessary for your information, nor, in receiving my nephew, offend any feelings he may still nurture. Indeed, he can, if he likes, read the letter for his own instruction in the privacy of the room that is already awaiting him. But Carl had no feelings for that girl. In the thronging memories of a past that was waning further and further, she sat in her kitchen, at the kitchen cabinet, propping her elbows upon it. She would be looking at him when he occasionally came to get a glass of water for his father, or convey some instructions from his mother. Sometimes, sitting awkwardly at the side of the cabinet, the girl would be writing a letter, drawing her inspiration from Carl's face. Sometimes she would cover her eyes with her hand, then no words would get through to her. Sometimes she would kneel in her tiny room next to the kitchen, praying to a wooden cross. Carl, passing by, would observe her timidly through the crack of the slightly open door. Sometimes she would dash around the kitchen, and, cackling like a witch, recoil whenever Carl crossed her path. Sometimes, after Carl came in, she would shut the kitchen door, clutching its knob until he said he wanted to leave. Sometimes she would bring him things he didn't even want, and she would press them silently into his hands. But one day she said, "Carl." And amid his astonishment at the unexpected familiarity, she led him into her tiny room, sighing and grimacing, and locked the door. She then almost choked him in her embrace, and even while telling him to undress her, she actually undressed him and put him in her bed as if wanting to let no one else have him from now on, and to caress him and take care of him until the end of the world. "Carl, oh my Carl," she cried, as if clinching her possession of him by looking at him, while he saw nothing whatsoever and felt uncomfortable in the mass of warm bedclothes which she seemed to have piled up specifically for him. Then she lay down next to him and wanted to learn some secrets from him, but he couldn't tell her any. And she was annoyed, in jest or in earnest. She shook him, listened to his heart, offered her breast for him to listen in return, but couldn't get Carl to do so. She squeezed her naked belly against his body, groped about between his legs, and so repulsively that Carl shook his head and his neck out of the pillows. Then she thrust her belly against him several times. He felt as if she were a part of him, and perhaps that was the reason he was overwhelmed with a dreadful distress. Weeping, he at last got back to his own bed after she repeatedly begged him to see her again. That was all that had happened. And yet his uncle succeeded in making a mountain out of it. And apparently the cook had been thinking about Carl and had notified his uncle about his arrival. That was nice of her, and he would no doubt reward her eventually. "And now," exclaimed the senator, "I want you to tell me straight out whether or not I am your uncle." "You are my uncle," said Carl, kissing his hand and receiving a kiss on the forehead. "I am very glad that I have met you, but you are mistaken if you believe that my parents only speak ill of you. Aside from that, you have said a number of other things that are not so. That is, I don't think that it all really happened like that. You can't really judge things so accurately from here, and I also believe that it will do no harm if these gentlemen have been slightly misinformed in regard to details of a matter that they cannot really care so much about." "Well put," said the senator, leading Carl to the visibly sympathetic captain and asking, "Don't I have a splendid nephew?"
"I am delighted," said the captain, with a bow that only men with military training are capable of executing, "to have made your nephew's acquaintance, Senator. It is a special honor for my ship to have provided the setting for such a meeting. However, the crossing in steerage must have been very unpleasant. Why, who can say who else was there? Now we do everything possible to make the voyage as pleasant as possible for the people in steerage, far more, say, than the American lines do, but of course we still have not succeeded in making it a pleasure cruise."
"It did me no harm," said Carl.
"It did him no harm," the senator repeated, guffawing.
"Only I'm afraid I have lost my valise." And with that he remembered everything that had happened and everything that still had to be done. He looked around and saw all those present in the same places, gaping at him, mute with awe and amazement.
Only the port officials, so far as their smug and severe faces permitted the slightest access, displayed regret at having come at such an inopportune moment, and the watch now lying in front of them was probably more important to them than anything that was happening or might still happen in the room. The first person to express his sympathy after the captain was, oddly enough, the stoker. "My heartiest congratulations," he said, shaking Carl's hand, whereby he partly wanted to express something like appreciation. When he then tried to turn to the senator with the same words, the senator drew back as if the stoker were overstepping his bounds, and the stoker instantly retreated. However, the others now saw what was to be done, and they promptly formed a chaotic throng around Carl and the senator. Indeed, Carl received congratulations even from Shoeball, accepting them and thanking him. The last to join them in the restored peace and quiet were the port officials, who uttered two English words which made a ludicrous impression. The senator was fully in the mood to completely relish the pleasure of reminding himself and the others of less significant details, which, of course, were not only tolerated by all of them, but welcomed with great interest. Thus he pointed out that he had taken Carl's most salient features, as listed in the cook's letter, and had recorded them in his notebook should unexpected use of them prove necessary. Now, during the stoker's unendurable prattling, the senator had pulled out the notebook for no other reason than to distract himself, and, purely for his own amusement, had compared the cook's observations with Carl's appearance, for they were correct, if not exactly up to a detective's standards. "And that's how one finds one's nephew," he concluded, sounding as if he wanted to be congratulated once again. "What's going to happen to the stoker now?" asked Carl, ignoring his uncle's latest story. He believed that in his new circumstances he could say whatever was on his mind. "The stoker will get what he deserves," said the senator, "and what the captain considers appropriate. I believe we have had enough, and more than enough, of the stoker, and I am sure that each of the gentlemen present here will concur." "But that is not the issue in a matter of justice," said Carl. He stood between his uncle and the captain, and, perhaps influenced by that position, he believed he could force a decision. And yet the stoker himself appeared to have given up all hope. His hands were half inside his trouser belt, which, because of his agitated movements, had been exposed along with a strip of a checkered shirt. This didn't trouble him in the least. He had bewailed his entire woe. Now let them see the few rags he had on his body, and then they could carry him away. He figured that the attendant and Shoeball, as the two lowest in rank here, should do him that final favor. Shoeball would then have his peace and no longer be driven to distraction, as the purser had phrased it. The captain would be able to hire whole crowds of Romanians. Romanian would be spoken everywhere, and perhaps everything might then indeed run more smoothly. No stoker would prattle away in the cashier's office. They would have a rather fond memory of only his last prattling, which, as the senator had explicitly stated, had indirectly led to his recognizing his nephew. Incidentally, this nephew had tried to be of service to the stoker several times, and had long since repaid him more than amply for his help with the recognition. It didn't even cross the stoker's mind to ask anything of him now. Besides, while he might be the senator's nephew, Carl was a long way from being the captain. And after all, the unpleasant verdict would be issuing from the captain's lips. Consistent with these thoughts, the stoker tried not to look at Carl, but, unfortunately, in this roomful of enemies, there was no other place for his eyes to linger. "Do not misunderstand the situation," the senator told Carl. "This may be a matter of justice, but at the same time it is a matter of discipline. On shipboard, both, and especially the latter, are subject to the captain's decision." "So they are," murmured the stoker. Anyone who heard him and caught his drift smiled queasily. "Moreover, the captain's official duties undoubtedly accumulate to an unbelievable degree precisely during the arrival in New York, and we have already hindered him so greatly in performing them that it is high time we left the ship rather than make matters worse.
by permitting any utterly unwelcome interference to turn this petty bickering between two engine men into an incident. By the by, I perfectly understand what you're doing, my dear nephew, but that is precisely what gives me the right to lead you away from here as swiftly as possible. I will have a rowboat lowered for you immediately, said the captain, who, to Carl's astonishment, didn't utter even the slightest protest against the senator's words, which, after all, could undoubtedly be viewed as self-abasement on his uncle's part. The purser scurried over to the desk and telephoned the captain's order to the boatswain. Time is running out, Carl said to himself, but I can't do anything without offending everyone. I can't just desert my uncle now, right after he's found me again. The captain is certainly polite, but that's all. His politeness stops at discipline, and my uncle has probably expressed the captain's innermost thoughts. I don't want to talk to Shoeball. I even regret shaking his hand. And the rest of the people here are worthless. And thinking those thoughts, Carl slowly walked over to the stoker, pulled the man's right hand out of his belt, and held it playfully in his hand. "Why don't you say something?" he asked. "Why do you put up with everything?" The stoker merely knitted his brow as if searching for the right words for what he had to say. Meanwhile, he peered down at Carl's hand and his own. "You have suffered an injustice like no one else on this ship. I know it for a fact." And Carl drew his fingers to and fro between those of the stoker, who looked around with glistening eyes, as if experiencing a delight that no one ought to begrudge him. "But you have to defend yourself. Reply yes or no, otherwise no one will have the least inkling of the truth. You must promise to do as I say, for I have every reason to fear that I will no longer be able to help you." And now Carl wept as he kissed the stoker's hand, taking that chapped, almost lifeless hand and pressing it to his cheek like a treasure that must be given up. But his uncle, the senator, was already at his side, pulling him away, albeit with only the gentlest pressure. "The stoker seems to have bewitched you," he said, and gazed knowingly over Carl's head at the captain. "You felt abandoned, then you found the stoker, and you are now grateful to him. That's quite praiseworthy, but don't, if only for my sake, go too far, and please try to understand your position." Outside the door there were noises. Shouts were heard, and it even sounded as if someone were being shoved brutally against the door. A sailor walked in, rather seedy-looking, and wearing a girl's apron. "There's a crowd of people outside," he yelled, thrusting out his elbows as if he were still in the throng. He finally pulled himself together and was about to salute the captain when he noticed his apron, yanked it off, threw it on the floor, and shouted, "This is disgusting! They've tied a girl's apron on me!" But then he clicked his heels and saluted. Someone was about to laugh, but the captain snapped, "This is what I call a cheerful state of affairs. Just who is outside?" "Those are my witnesses," said Shoeball, stepping forward. "Please accept my humblest apologies for their unseemly behavior. When people have a voyage behind them, they sometimes go crazy." "Call them in immediately," the captain ordered, and promptly turning to the senator, he said courteously but quickly, "Please be so kind, my dear senator, as to take your nephew and follow this sailor who will conduct you to the rowboat. I need hardly tell you, senator, how pleased and honored I am to have made your personal acquaintance. I only hope that I will soon have the opportunity, senator, to resume our interrupted conversation about American naval conditions, and that it will then perhaps again be interrupted in as agreeable a manner as today. At present, this one nephew is quite enough for me," said Carl's uncle, laughing. "And now please accept my sincerest gratitude for your kindness, and let me bid you farewell. Incidentally, it is by no means unlikely that we," and he hugged Carl ardently, "might be with you for a lengthy spell on our next voyage to Europe." "The pleasure would be all mine," said the captain. The two gentlemen shook hands. Carl could only graze the captain's hand mutely and hurriedly, for the captain was already preoccupied with the perhaps 15 men who, with Shoeball at their head, were entering the room, somewhat perplexed but very noisy. The sailor asked the senator if he himself could take the lead, and he then opened a path through the crowd for the senator and Carl, who easily made their way through the bowing people.
It appeared as if these actually good-natured souls regarded Shubal's quarrel with the stoker as a joke, which not even the captain's presence could induce them to take seriously. Carl also noticed Lena, the kitchen maid, who, winking merrily at him, put on the apron that the man had thrown down, for it was hers. Still following the sailor, Carl and his uncle left the office and turned into a short corridor which, after a couple of steps, brought them to a small door, behind which a short staircase led down to the rowboat that had been rigged up for them. Their guide leaped straight into it at one swoop, while the sailors in the boat stood up and saluted. The senator was warning Carl to exert caution in climbing down, when Carl, still on the top step, burst into violent sobs. The senator put his right hand under Carl's chin, held him tight, and stroked him with his left hand. In this way, closely entwined, they climbed down gingerly, step by step, and trod into the boat, where the senator chose a comfortable seat for Carl right across from himself. At a signal from the senator, the sailors pushed off from the ship and were instantly rowing hard. No sooner had they moved a few yards than Carl unexpectedly discovered that they were on the same side of the ship as the windows of the office. All three windows were crowded with Shubal's witnesses, who greeted them with friendly waves. Carl's uncle waved back, and the sailor accomplished the feat of blowing them a kiss without so much as interrupting the even rhythm of the oars. It was truly as if the stoker no longer existed. Carl peered more sharply at his uncle, whose knees were almost touching his, and he wondered whether this man could ever replace the stoker for him. Indeed, his uncle, avoiding his gaze, kept staring at the waves that were lolloping around their boat.
This ends The Stoker. And now, a collection of stories, A Country Doctor.
The New Lawyer. We have a new lawyer, Dr. Bucephalus. Little in his appearance recalls the time when he was the warhorse of Alexander of Macedonia, but anyone familiar with the circumstances will notice a thing or two. Yet recently, on the perron of the courthouse, I saw even a very simple-minded court usher who, with the expert eye of a small-time patron at racetracks, was marveling at the lawyer as, lifting his thighs aloft, he climbed from step to step, his footfalls ringing on the marble. In general, the bar approves of Bucephalus's admission. With astonishing insight, people tell themselves that Bucephalus, given the modern social system, is in a quandary, and that in any case he deserves a friendly reception for that reason, and also for his significance in world history. Today, no one can deny it, there is no Alexander the Great. Some people do know how to murder, nor do they lack the skill of hurling a lance across a banquet table and striking a friend. And for many, Macedonia is too confining, so that they curse Philip the father. But no one, no one can lead us to India. Even in those days, the gates of India were unattainable, yet their direction was pointed out by the tip of the royal sword. By now those gates have been carried off to some other location altogether, and today they are wider and higher. No one points out their direction. Many people hold swords, but only to brandish them wildly, and the gaze that tries to follow them grows confused. So, perhaps it is best to bury oneself in the law books, as Bucephalus has done. Free, in quiet lamplight, far from the uproar of Alexander's battle, his flanks not squeezed by the rider's loins, he reads, turning the pages of our ancient tomes. A Country Doctor. I was in a great predicament. An urgent trip lay ahead of me. A dangerously ill patient awaited me in a village 10 leagues away. A heavy blizzard filled the vast space between me and him. I did have a wagon, lightweight, with large wheels, just the right kind of wagon for our country roads. Bundled up in my fur coat, holding my instrument bag, I stood in the courtyard ready to travel. But the horse was lacking. The horse. My own horse had died the previous night because of its overexertion in this icy winter. My housemaid was now running around the village trying to borrow a horse. But it was hopeless, I knew it. And covering up with more and more snow, becoming more and more immobile, I stood there, forlorn. My maid appeared at the gate, alone, swinging the lantern. Naturally. Who would lend someone a horse at such a time, for such a trip? I strode back across the courtyard. I could think of no solution. Confused, tormented, I kicked the brittle door of the pigsty, which had not been used in years. The door opened, banging to and fro on its hinges. Warmth and aroma emerged as if from horses. A dim stable lantern swayed inside on a rope. A man, cowering in the low shed, exposed his open, blue-eyed face. "Should I harness up?" he asked, creeping out on all fours. I could think of nothing to say, so I stooped down only to see what else was in the sty. The maid stood beside me. "You never know what you've got in your own house," she said. And we both laughed. "Hey, brother! Hey, sister!" shouted the stableman, and two horses, mighty creatures with strong flanks, tucking their legs in close to their bodies, lowering their well-shaped heads like camels, shuffled out one behind the other, solely by twisting their rumps out of the doorway, which they filled completely. But then they promptly stood upright on high legs with densely steaming bodies. "Help him," I said. And the willing girl dashed over to hand the wagon harness to the stableman. But no sooner did she reach him than he clutched her and banged his face against her. She screamed and fled back to me. The red imprint of 2 rows of teeth were left on the girl's cheek. "You swine!" I yelled furiously. "Do you want a whipping?" But then I promptly remembered that he was a stranger, that I didn't know where he came from, and that he was helping me voluntarily, while everyone else had refused. As if knowing my thoughts, he does not hold my threat against me. Instead, still busy with the horses, he turns toward me only once. "Get in," he then says, and indeed, everything is ready. I have never, I note to myself, ridden with such a beautiful pair of horses, and I get in cheerfully. "But I'm driving," I tell him. "You don't know the way." "Certainly," he says. "I'm not going with you anyhow. I'm staying with Rosa." "No," Rosa shouts and runs into the house with a correct foreboding of her inescapable fate. I hear the jingling chain that she draws across the door. I hear the lock snap. I also see her dashing through the hallway and the rooms, putting out all the lights to avoid being found. "You're coming along," I tell the stableman, "or I won't go, as urgent as this trip may be. I wouldn't dream of giving you the girl as the price for this trip." "Giddy-app," he says, clapping his hands. The wagon is yanked away like a log in a current. I hear the door of my house bursting and splintering under the stableman's onslaught. Then my eyes and ears are filled with a roar that penetrates equally to all my senses. But even that lasts only a moment, for, as if my patient's farmyard opened up right in front of my gates, I am already there. The horses stand calmly. The snow has stopped falling. Moonlight all around. My patient's parents hurry out of the house, his sister behind them. They practically lift me from the wagon. I glean nothing from their confused chatter. The air in the sick room is almost unbreathable. The neglected hearth oven is smoking. I will push open the window, but first I want to look at the patient. Gaunt, no fever, not cold, not warm, with vacant eyes, shirtless. The boy heaves himself up under the feather bed, clings to my neck, whispers into my ear, "Doctor, let me die." I peer around. No one has heard it. The parents stand mute, leaning forward, waiting for my verdict. The sister has brought a chair for my bag. I open my bag and search through my instruments. The boy keeps groping for me from the bed to remind me of his plea. I take hold of some pincers, check them in the candlelight, and put them down again. Yes, I think blasphemously. In such cases, the gods help, sending the missing horse, adding a second one because of the urgency, bestowing the stable boy on top of everything else. Only now do I think of Rosa. What do I do? How can I rescue her? How can I get her out from under that stable boy, 10 leagues away, uncontrollable horses in front of my wagon? These horses, which have now somehow loosened the reins, pushed open the windows, I don't know how, from the outside. Each has stuck its head through a window, and, undaunted by the family's shrieks, they gape at the patient. I'm driving right home, I think, as if the horses were asking me to travel. But the sister believes I am dazed by the heat, and so I put up with her removing my fur coat. A glass of rum is set down for me. The old man pats me on the back. The sacrifice of his treasure justifies this familiarity. I shake my head. I feel nauseated within the narrow circle of the old man's thoughts. That is the only reason why I refuse to drink. The mother stands by the bed, luring me over. I obey, and while a horse neighs loudly toward the ceiling, I place my head on the boy's chest, and he shudders under my wet beard. It confirms what I know. The boy is healthy, his circulation a bit poor. He is saturated with coffee by the worried mother, but healthy. And it would be best to kick him out of bed. I am no do-gooder, and so I let him lie. I am employed by the district, and perform my responsibility thoroughly, almost overdoing it. Though poorly paid, I am generous and helpful with the poor. I still have to take care of Rosa. Then the boy can have his way, and I too will want to die. What am I doing here in this endless winter? My horse has died, and no one in the village will lend me his own. I have to pull my team from the pigsty. If they did not happen to be horses, then I would have to ride with sows. That's how it is. And I nod to the family. They know nothing about it, and if they did know, they would not believe it. Writing prescriptions is easy, but communicating with people is hard. Well, then I am done with my visit. Once again they have summoned me for nothing. I am used to it. With the help of my night bell, the entire district torments me. But having to give up Rosa this time, that lovely girl who has lived in my home for years, barely noticed by me, this sacrifice is too great. And I have to come up with sophistry, devise some makeshift solution to avoid pouncing on this family who, after all, cannot for the life of them return Rosa to me. But when I close my bag and signal for my fur coat, and the family members stand together, the father snuffling over the rum glass in his hand, the mother probably disappointed in me, just what do people expect anyway? Tearfully biting her lips, and a sister flourishing a blood-stained towel, I am somehow willing to admit, if need be, that the boy may be sick, after all. I go to him. He smiles at me as if I were bringing him the strongest soup of all. Ah, now both horses are neighing. The noise, probably ordained by a higher power, is meant to facilitate the examination. And now I find, yes, the boy is ill. In his right side, near the hip, a hand-sized wound has opened up. Pink in many nuances, dark in its depth, lighter toward the edges, soft-grained, with uneven clots of blood, and open like the surface of a mine. That much from the distance. A closer inspection reveals a complication. Who can look at that without whistling softly? Worms, equal in length and thickness to my little finger, rosy in color and also splashed with blood, caught inside the wound, with tiny white heads, with many tiny legs, wriggle up to the light. Poor boy, there is no helping you. I have located your big wound. You are being destroyed by that blossom in your side. The family is happy. They see me doing something. The sister says so to the mother to the father to several guests who, balancing with outstretched arms, tiptoe in through the moonlight of the open door. "Will you save me?" the boy whispers, sobbing, utterly blinded by the life in his wound. That is what the people are like in my area, always demanding the impossible of a doctor. They have lost the ancient faith. The pastor sits at home, unraveling his liturgical vestments one by one. But the doctor is supposed to accomplish everything with his delicate surgical hand. Well, whatever. I did not offer myself. If you people misuse me for sacred purposes, then I will put up with that too. What more could I ask? I, an old country doctor, bereft of my housemaid. And so they come, the family and the village elders, and undress me. A school chorus with the teacher at its head stands outside the house, singing these words to an extremely simple tune. Strip him, then he'll heal. And if he doesn't heal, then kill him. He's only a doctor. Only a doctor. Then I am stripped bare, and my fingers in my beard, my head bowed, I calmly gaze at the people. I'm quite composed, and superior to them all, and will remain so, even though it will not help me. For now they take me by my head and feet and carry me to the bed. They place me along the wall on the side with the wound. Then they all leave the room. The door is closed. The singing dies out. Clouds pass across the moon. The bedding lies warm around me. In the windows, the horses' heads waver like shadows. "You know," someone says into my ear, "I have very little confidence in you. Why, you were only shaken off here. You didn't come on your own 2 feet. Instead of helping me, you crowd my deathbed. I would love to scratch your eyes out." "Right," I say. "It is shameful. But I am a doctor, after all. What should I do? Believe me, it is no easier for me." "I should content myself with that excuse? Oh, I have to. I always have to content myself. I came into the world with a lovely wound. That was my only endowment." "Young friend," I say, "your problem is that you don't have an overall grasp of things. I, who have been in all sick rooms, far and wide, say to you, your wound is not so bad. Created at a sharp angle, with two strokes of the axe. Many people offer a side, and barely catch the sound of the axe in the forest, much less hear it getting closer to them. Is that really so, or are you deceiving me in my fever? It is really so. Take a district physician's word of honor. And he took it, and fell silent. But now it was time to think about saving myself. The horses were still standing faithfully in their places. Clothes, fur, and bag were quickly snatched up. I did not care to waste time dressing. If the horses raced as they had coming here, I would leap from this bed to mine, as it were. Obediently, a horse backed away from the window. I tossed the bundle into the wagon. My fur coat soared too far. It clung to a hook by only one sleeve. Good enough. I swung myself on the horse. The reins loosely trailing behind, one horse barely tied to the other, the wagon bumbling behind them, the fur was the last thing in the snow. Giddy-ap, I said. But the movement was not lively. Slowly, like old men, we moved through snowy wasteland. For a long, long time we could hear the new but defective singing of the children. Cheer up, all you patients. The doctor has been placed in your bed. Never will I come home at this rate. My flourishing practice is doomed. A successor robs me, but to no avail, for he cannot replace me. The disgusting stableman rages in my home. Rosa is his victim. I refuse to picture it. Naked, at the mercy of the frost in this most wretched era, with an earthly wagon, unearthly horses, I, an old man, wander about. My fur coat hangs from the back of the wagon, but I cannot reach it. And not one of my agile patients, that riff-raff, will lift a finger. Deceived. Deceived. Once you have responded to the false alarm of the night bell, it can never be made good. Up in the gallery. If some frail, consumptive equestrian on a reeling horse in the ring, in front of a tireless audience, were uninterruptedly driven around in a circle for months on end by a ruthless, whip-cracking ringmaster, whirring on the horse, blowing kisses, swaying at the waist, and if this performance, under the incessant roar of the orchestra and the ventilators, were to continue into the ever-widening, dreary future, accompanied by applause that kept waning and swelling up again, from hands that are actually steam hammers, then perhaps a young gallery visitor might hurry down the long stairway through all the tiers, plunge into the ring and shout, "Halt!" over the fanfares of the ever-adjusting orchestra. But, since it is not like that, since a beautiful lady in white and red, comes soaring in through the curtains that the proud, liveried footmen open before her, since the ringmaster, devotedly seeking her eyes, breathing toward her in an animal stance, since he lovingly hands her up on the dappled gray horse as if she were his utterly beloved granddaughter taking off on a dangerous journey, since he cannot make up his mind to signal with the whip, but finally pulls himself together and cracks it smartly, runs alongside the horse, his mouth open, follows the rider's leap with sharp eyes, scarcely believes her skill, tries to warn her by shouting in English, furiously admonishes the grooms, who clutch hoops, to be very attentive, since before the great breakneck leap he raises his hands, beseeching the orchestra to hush, since he finally lifts the girl down from the trembling horse, kisses her on both cheeks, and considers no tribute from the public satisfactory enough,
while she herself, supported by him, high on the tips of her toes, in a whirl of dust, her arms outspread, her head thrown back, tries to share her bliss with the entire circus, since this is so. The gallery visitor puts his face on the railing, and, sinking into the concluding march as into a heavy dream, he weeps without realizing it.
While love went riding, she rode all the day. She rode to the devil and asked him to pay. The devil was wiser. It's time to repent. He asked her to give back the money she spent. My wild love went riding, she rode to the sea. She gathered together some shells for her head. She rode and she rode on, she rode for a while. Stop for an evening and laid her head down. She rode on to Christmas, she rode to the farm, she rode to Japan and re-entered a town. By this time the it changed 1 degree. She asked for the people to let her go free. My wild love is crazy, she screams like a bird, she moans like a cat when she wants to be heard. My wild love went riding, she rode for an hour. She rode and she rested, and then she rode on.
Right, come on. Dinosaures, mort, les mammouths, mort, Néandertal, mort, morte, les tigresses à dents de sabre, morte, les pharaons sont morts, tous, morts. Les Incas, mortes,
mortes.
Les arbres,
morts.
Les cailloux,
morts.
Les dodos,
morts.
Le sommeil,
morts.
L'espoir,
morts.
Morts, morts.
Toutes,
morts.
Toutes, morts.
Tous, morts.
Tous,
morts.
Tous,
morts.
Tous, morts.
Tous, morts.
Tous,
morts.
Tous,
morts.
Tous,
morts.
Tous,
morts.
Tous,
morts.
Tous,
morts.
Tous,
morts.
Tous,
morts.
Tous,
morts.
abattoir. Je vais finir dans un mouroir. Pas voir leur vrai partir. Est-ce que les...